How's that? Is that better?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I wanted to start this morning where you are. You are single. Every one of you is single. And probably most, if not all of you, want to be married. And so singleness is a time of, it's a kind of suffering. Because you desire marriage, you want to be married one day, and yet you're not right now. And I wanted to talk to you first just about how to think about your singleness. So this is Ecclesiastes. If you'll go there with me, Ecclesiastes 3. And this is written by an old wise man. And he's seen everything, and he's done everything. He's done many things he shouldn't have done. And he's seen everything in everybody else's life. And traditionally, this is understood to be Solomon. And here's what he says, chapter 3, verse 1. He says, "For everything there is a season." So that means there's a season for every part of life. And I want you to think about, there's a season for singleness, and there's a season for marriage. Look what he says. "Everything there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die. Usually births are joyous and death is sad. There's a time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn, and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones, and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace, and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to seek, and a time to lose, a time to keep, and a time to cast away, a time to tear," and this is probably referring to tearing garments, so someone has lost something, and they're grieving, they're mourning, and they tear their clothes. That was a tradition in the Old Testament. So a time to tear and a time to sow, a time to keep silent and a time to speak. And this is probably also referring to mourning. When someone loses a loved one, there are really no words. What do you do then? Someone's lost something terrible and they're grieving and mourning. You just go and you just sit with them. There's really nothing to say. Silent presence. So there's a time to keep quiet. And the Bible also speaks of that a word in season is good. It's healing. And so there's a time to speak, a time to love, and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. And these show that the time to love, the time to hate, this is not, all these things aren't good, actually. There's a brokenness here. There's something wrong with the world. And so look at verse 9. It says, "What gain has the worker from his toil?" So here's the question for you. By working really, really hard and doing all the right things and living for Jesus, can you change these times? You're going to get out of death. You're going to get out of mourning. So you can do everything just right, and you're not going to change the times. So you have no gain from your toil, is what it's saying. You're not going to get anything really lastingly satisfying in this world by working hard. Because the world is broken. Then verse 10, he says, now he's interpreting it, okay? So he's just given this poem, and now he's explaining the poem, and he says, "I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with." So now we see where these times really come from. God is behind them all. He's sovereign over it all. His providence is working all of the seasons. This wheel keeps on turning because of God's sovereign decree and his providence and working it all out. And there's no way to change that. So you can either learn to live in it as God commands you, or it'll just crush you. You're not going to change it, you see? So he has made everything beautiful in its time. That's the next verse, verse 11. So in time, things become beautiful. Have you ever experienced a moment in time that's just, you feel like I could just live here forever? I love this moment in time. And then there are other moments in time that are sad and grievous, and you can't get out of them. You ever experienced that? In time, he makes all things beautiful. And then it says, also, he has put eternity into man's heart so that he cannot find out what God has done from beginning to end. And here's what this probably means. That God, unlike animals, human beings can tell the difference between past and present and future, and we remember the beautiful seasons. And we can hope for beautiful seasons in the future. And yet, we also can't be fully satisfied in the beautiful seasons. It's never quite enough. This is why Ecclesiastes, you've heard where it says, vanity, vanity, all is vanity and striving after the wind. What that means is vanity, the word vanity, is literally a puff of smoke or vapor that appears for a moment, and it might even have a kind of elegance to it and beauty, and then it's just gone. And that's what the pleasures of this world are like. They're a puff of smoke. They're there for a moment, and then they're gone. And it says, you can't find out what God has done from beginning to end. So you're not going to be able to crack the code of this world so that you can live in it with no sorrow. That's what this is saying. You're never going to figure out how to live in this world so that there's no suffering, no pain, no sorrow. It's not going to happen. And why? Why do you think that's not going to happen? This is your time to answer. Why do you think you're not? Because the world is broken. And God cursed it. The Bible says that the creation was subjected to futility. That's the same word that's used in Ecclesiastes. Vanity or futile. The creation was subjected to futility. Not willingly, but because of him who subjected it. So it's the same word in the Greek Septuagint, right? So the Greek translation of the Old Testament uses the same word that Paul uses in Romans for futile. And that's what's happened here, is because of the fall, everything is, that there's futility in this world. So now, okay, so that's a very dark picture, right? The world is fallen, the world is broken. How do we live in it? And he draws two conclusions, and I want you to think about this in terms of your singleness. There's a pain in singleness, isn't there? Most of you are old enough to desire to be married one day, if not all of you. You long for that, and you wonder about it, and there's an uncertainty, and there's fear, and there's angst, and there's worry, and there's all these things. Thoughts about yourself, thoughts about others, and this is distracting you, it's occupying your mind all the time. Well, he reaches two conclusions. And conclusion one is in verse 12, conclusion two is in verse 14. Okay. And the conclusions, we know their conclusions because he says, I perceived one thing and then I perceived another thing. Here's the first conclusion. I perceived that there is nothing better, that is under the sun, nothing better than this. This isn't, by the way, what he's about to say isn't great or the best. He's just saying there's nothing better. There is nothing better for them than to be joyful. There's nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. And so what does he mean? Look what he says, verse 13. Also, that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil, Alan's been telling us about. Take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. So instead of longing for the next season, which, by the way, isn't really going to satisfy you, even if it's better, it says, today, right now, with your eyes on the present, enjoy your food. Eat it slowly. Savor the taste of it. Sip your sweet tea with pleasure. Enjoy the cool breeze that blows through your hair. The beauty of the ocean, the sand in your toes. Enjoy common conversations with people. These are God's gifts. It doesn't get better, ever. That's what he's saying. It does not get better than that under the sun. To receive it as a gift from God, not to try to squeeze infinite lasting pleasure out of your food or out of your work or whatever. No, you're not going to get it. That you receive it as a gift from God's hand and you thank him for it. He gave this to me. I'm just going to enjoy it knowing that he gave it to me and it reminds me of him. This is God's gift to man. So first is to take pleasure. The second is to do good. What do you think do good means? While you're taking pleasure in the moment, what does it mean to do good? Does anyone know the last thing in Ecclesiastes? The conclusion of the matter is, does anyone know this? To fear God and keep his commandments. So what does it mean to do good? Y'all are all Reformed Baptists, right? Some of us should. What is the commandments? To not sin, yeah. So any sin is a transgression of the law of God, right? Sin is lawlessness, 1 John says. So what are the commandments of God, though? Where do we find them summarily listed? It's the Ten Commandments. That's the summary of God's moral law. We know that because that's the high point of the expression of God's law in the Old Testament. No other law looks like that one. Every other law is derived from it. Okay? They're written by God's own finger in tablets of stone. And they're then, the New Testament says, is written on the hearts of believers, on tablets of human hearts. Same laws. And so what do you do in the moment? You're in one season. You are in a season of suffering as singles of a kind. So what do? Instead of longing for a new season, enjoy the moment of today, what God has given you today, and keep the commandments, doing good, loving God and loving others. And that's how you live. That's the first conclusion. I perceived that. He perceived this. The second thing he perceives is in verse 14, that whatever God does endures forever. This means that the seasons won't be changed. The cycles, the seasons are going to continue. Nothing can be added to it because nothing can be taken away because God has done it. In other words, if you add something, he'll take it away. And if you take it away, he'll add it back eventually because his purpose is accomplished. And then here's what he says. So that, why does God make these seasons? Why does he show us that we're not in charge of our lives? Why does he bring us in submission to his providence so that we can't control our worlds? Look what it says. So that people fear before him. So you stand back and you look in awe and in wonder at this God who's made the heavens and the earth and who governs all things according to his good pleasure. And there's nothing we can do to thwart his purpose. And he does all that he pleases in the heavens above and the earth beneath. And what's our reaction to this great and sovereign and all-powerful God? We stand back in awe and wonder, and we have a reverential fear of him because he's so good and full of grace and love. And it's not the way a slave fears a master. It's the way a son should fear his father. It's the way I'll give you an illustration of the kind of fear we should have. If you've ever been to the zoo, you've seen a lion in a cage. Some of these zoos let them get close. I don't know if you've been to one like that, but here's a lion that's gotten close to you and he's in the cage. And what do you feel? And then he roars. You're not passive in that moment. If you're standing there, you're like, whoa, this is a mighty beast. And there's this kind of fear. There's a joy in it because he's beautiful and he's great. But there's this reverence. You don't want to tussle with that animal, right? So that's a reverential fear. There's a joyful, reverential awe. But now take the cage away. And that's just you and the lion and he's hungry. And what are you doing now? There's a different kind of fear, right? It's I'm going to die kind of fear, right? Well, the fear of God that we're supposed to have is a reverential fear that the God who would rightly destroy me and could do so doesn't. It's Jonathan Edwards' picture of the hand that holds the spider over the flame and loathes it but doesn't destroy it, and then ultimately catches it and redeems it and saves it from the flame. So it's God's power to destroy and hatred for us in our sins, but then love for us when we're tucked in Jesus, robed in his righteousness, and we fear him. So how do we live in the seasons, in the good seasons, in the happier ones? Because look, when we have a happy season, you know what happens? If it's not enough for us, if we're looking to the season to satisfy us. It enslaves us. That's what he's talked about already in chapter 2. And in the sad seasons, what happens? We say, God, I wish you'd give me more. That's the sinful nature. God, you haven't given me enough, even though you've given me what I want. And then if he takes something from us, God, I want something from you. And so in both cases, the sinful nature reacts wrongly. And instead of reacting that way, what we're supposed to do is fear God, keep his commandments, and enjoy the world that he's given us for what it is in the little moments. So that's how you think as a single. Do y'all have any thoughts or questions at this point? All right. We'll have a question time at the end for just to open it wide up for any and all questions. But right now I want to just go over a few things. We've talked about them before, so I think there's probably 4 new people this year. The rest of you aren't. But it's good for us to go over these things again and again, so we're going to. What is dating? Yeah, so culturally, dating is it's just having fun. It's recreation, right? And you might be kind of getting a sense of who you're interested in by dating and who you might want to marry, but you're not thinking about marrying. You're just thinking about enjoying life and that person romantically, and you're getting a taste of this kind of relationship and of that kind of relationship, and that's what dating is. So what are some problems with dating as I just described it? Yeah, it is, because what is it really saying? If I'm dating you for my recreation, who's important? It's incredibly selfish. It's about myself. And it has consequences, too. What happens if you're dating someone and things don't go well and you just dump them and you get the next one? And things don't go well and you dump them and you go to the next one. What is that teaching you? Yeah, well, when sins start to show themselves, you just get out of the relationship. How's that going to work in marriage? What's it training you to do in marriage? Right, so it's teaching you to think about romantic love in a way that is not true. Because that's not what marriage is. It's not recreational. It's not for your personal pleasure. And it's not a situation where you get into it and if things go bad, you just get out. Or things are difficult. Another problem with dating is it gives you a taste for variety. So how's a taste for variety work out in marriage? If you're used to variety and you like variety, that's not a good thing in marriage, is it? So dating, just practically, just thinking through it, just logically, it doesn't make sense in terms of what God says marriage is. And also it's not revealed in the Bible. You don't see any encouragement or commendation of this in the scriptures anywhere. This is not the biblical pattern for romance and romantic love. And so if that's not the right pattern, what is? Some say courtship. Some people, there's some do what? Friendship. There's some who have a very, very narrow, rigid definition of courtship. I'm not opposed to the word, but I just use a different word. I say intentional relationships. Okay, so you can call it courtship if you want to. Some people do. But so what does this look like? This looks like this. It looks like you are not building a romantic relationship with a woman that you're interested in. Instead, you're getting to know her and the rest of your peers in groups, and particularly in church. So you're observing different people, and you're keeping, there's a kind of difference or separation that has to be there between you and women right now, men as well. So you observe them. But let's say you come to a place where you're, well, so how do you know when you can move beyond that? This is a question for you. How do you know when you can move beyond just observation, which is where most of you who are young right now and not even old enough to get married, that's all you should be doing. You should not be building into a relationship so that your heart is getting all entangled. That's wrong, because that's not going to lead anywhere good. You should just be observing each other in groups, and part of the group and friends as groups, right? So how do you move beyond that? When do you move beyond it? You tell me. Well, before that.
Well, I know you said before that the guy has to be both emotionally and physically able to care for a woman before he should even approach her father.
Yeah, I've used, this is just a little thing I've used to try to get at the whole of the person, okay? So you can use different words, but I use ready and willing and able, okay? So ready, willing, able. The first is ready. And ready in terms of what? What do you think it means to be ready to be married? Yes, you have to be old enough, I think, is just the first bottom line. You have to be mature enough so children don't marry. Men and women marry, right? So that's the first. Along with that, are you mature in Christ to marry? Are you someone who understands the grace of God, and you're not just selfishly entering into this for your own selfish gratification, but you desire to enter into a covenant of love with someone. So that's ready. So physically old enough, mature enough, and also spiritually mature enough to get married. Secondly is willing. And what I mean by this is someone that if you were to enter into a relationship with, you'd really want to marry. So you're not playing games here. So romantic relationship should always be based on that first you're ready for it. Secondly, that you really want to get married. And this is someone that you think you want to marry. So you're not just testing it out. You're not entering into a romance to test. This is someone you really think that you could marry. It's someone that you're attracted to. It's someone that, you know, you're not being forced together with, but you want to marry, right? So do you think if there's a godly man and a godly woman, that if you meet a godly woman, you should just marry her? Huh? No. No, that's the first step. Certainly she needs to be a godly woman, just like you should be a godly man, and you know, vice versa. But there needs to be some willingness. There's an attractiveness and a suitedness and a fittedness that's beyond that. That's natural. And so that's what we're getting at under willing. So there's some views in Christianity that say if he's a godly man and you're a godly woman, you should get married. And one of them doesn't want to, and they just feel like it's God's will. Don't make that mistake. You should desire this, okay? And when I said able, it's getting at what Colmer was talking about. So ready, willing, able is that you need to be financially able as a man to support a wife. So you have the means to support her practically. You have a career path. Now, I want to put a caveat to this, because there are today what I'm running into mostly among young men is they want to be fully established in their careers, making lots of money, and have built their own kingdom, and then they'll get married. That's very common now, and it is not biblical to go that far. We're not talking about Abel in the sense of you're 35 years old with a career and you're established, and now you're getting married. That actually creates temptations and all kinds of things that aren't good for you. You should marry before that if you desire to do so and not put it off just for a career. And yet, you should be able to support her, and you should have an income that's capable of doing it, and a plan to go forward with it. So, questions at this point. So this is just a practical thought at the beginning. Ready, willing, and able. Do you have a question or an objection? Make sense to you? Okay. Now let's look at what, I'm talking to the guys now mostly, but let's look at Ephesians 5. So this is addressed to husbands, but it's really talking about men, masculinity in general. How are men to be? What does it mean to be a man? And so I'm talking to the men, but I would encourage the women to listen to this because this is what a man's like. This is the kind of man you should receive a pursuit from. Ephesians 5, verse 25. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. So there's this self-sacrifice. It's Christ-likeness. Masculinity looks like the cross. Looks like death to self to serve and love and protect and provide for another. To lead her in grace and with sacrificial servant leadership. So a man is not someone who's so insecure that he's domineering, that he gets his sense of righteousness out of always proving himself right and controlling other people. That's not a man. A man is someone who's like Jesus here, whose identity is settled in Christ, and he dies to himself and he loves another and he protects her. Then verse 26, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of the water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she may be holy and without blemish. In the same way, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes it and cherishes it, just as Christ does the church, because we are members of his body. So here I want to focus on how this plays out in a relationship, in leadership. The man should take the initiative. Didn't Jesus take the initiative in redeeming his people? And even see this in the garden. You know, God took the bone out of the rib out of Adam, and Adam's the first one to speak to her. So Adam's taking the initiative. Christ took the initiative with his church to redeem them. And so, men, it is not manly to wait on the woman to take the initiative. A lot of guys are like this. They want to see if the woman's interested first. They want to see if there's some sort of desire on her part before they make themselves vulnerable, before they put themselves out there. They want to, kind of get a sense, and they don't even want to talk clearly. They just want to have conversations and read between the lines and get a sense, and then they might approach her. That's not self-sacrificial. In fact, the guy may want a woman to flirt with him. Let's talk and let's see if the girl's going to flirt with me. And what is flirting, by the way? It's stirring up romantic emotions. And it's often just talking and giggling and playing, and there's no clarity there, but it's all about getting that person to notice you in a romantic way. And you know what flirting really is? It's leading. And what's a woman doing if she's flirting with you? She's leading you. It's actually the role of a man. Right? And so, women, if you're flirting with a man to get his attention romantically, you're being the man. And if he's being captivated by that, he's not a man at all. There's no conversation. There's no clarity. It's just, you know, this romantic flirting. I'm not talking about just casual conversation. I'm talking about a real flirtatiousness that seeks to draw out another. And so men need to take the lead, and it's, you don't take the lead by waiting on her to flirt with you and by seeing if she's interested and then, you know, saying subtle things and trying to grow this kind of secretly without being vulnerable or something. Here's what you do. You have to be very clear with your words. So how do you know when to take that step? What do you do? How do you know? So you're interested, here's a girl? Yes. You pray. You seek God's wisdom. You pray, Lord, help me to see this woman for what's true, and help me to understand your word in relationship to this woman. And so you read your Bible, and you know what the scriptures say about a godly woman, men. So you pray, you seek the Lord in his word. You also seek other godly counsel before you start leading. True leadership is not independent. So you seek godly counsel. Who should you seek godly counsel from?
Your father.
You should seek first and foremost from your father. You honor your father and mother. That's the fifth commandment. And as a man, you go to him and you say, Dad, what do you think? And you let him think with you about it. You may go seek counsel from a pastor. And usually, in Christian context where it's understood, even if it's not, but it's very important when there's a, she has a, you know, you're looking at a Christian woman who has a Christian father, you should go to him and talk to him as well. I used to say that's absolute. I did that with Joy's dad. I went to him and said, can I pursue your daughter? And so I believe in doing that. But I do think there are some exceptions, like if he's not a believer or if he's totally out of the picture or whatever, there are certain kinds. So it's not a law, but I think it's generally wise to approach her father and include him at the beginning. And so then what? So then everyone says go. It's good. Then what do you do? Huh? You talk to her father. You've talked to your father. You've talked to your pastors. You sought wisdom. Then what? Yeah, and then what's that talk look like? Some people think this is strange, what I'm about to tell you, but I think it's important. Not everyone's the same, so this is a wisdom call. But at some level, it needs to be this. There needs to be clarity. Real clarity. I don't think that's strange, by the way. Some people think that's unromantic and that in this day and age, we just need to fall into this and just feel our way through it and not have That's totally wrong. There should be clarity. And so what do you tell them? Well, guys, you say after you've sought her father and your pastor, you go up to her and you say, I'm interested in pursuing you romantically to marriage. Now, you're not asking her to marry you, right? You're not saying, will you marry me? You don't know. But what you tell her, here's what I told Joy. Just to give you the example. I told Joy, I said, Joy, if there's ever a time when I don't desire to pursue you to marriage, I'll let you know right away. So you can know, you can have confidence that as long as we're together, that I'm looking toward marriage. And we're not going to keep talking about it all the time. We're not going to go, you know, just romanticize about being married. But you're going to have clarity. Do you want to say something? You look like you
might want to say. No, just, yeah, I mean, that's exactly what you said. You asked the same of me.
Yeah, and I asked her the same. So there's an agreement. It's not an agreement to be married, but it's an agreement to grow together with that as the goal. And unless something surprising and unforeseen comes up, that will be the outcome. So questions at this point. How long? Yeah, I think it depends on the relationship and how things are going. In general, I would say really long ones aren't good, and really short ones aren't good either. So, and that's subjective. And you're going to rely upon, you know, your father and your pastor to help you with that. But I think it can go way too far in both directions. I've seen people, you know, they meet, they marry right away. And others, they wait years and years and years in this state of courting or intentional relationship. Other questions at this point?
One is the fact if a girl is flirting with you, and you're not necessarily trying to, and they keep flirting with you, and you talk to them about it, they say that that's just how they act, they aren't necessarily flirting with you. What should you do at that point?
Well, I want to say again here, guys, it's your job to take the lead. Women, you need not to flirt to draw out guys' attention. But guys, you need to take the lead, and you just need to put distance between you and that person, especially if you feel yourself being pulled into it, and it's not the right thing. So you pull away intentionally.
I think one thing that could be helpful there too, if this is someone you know very well enough that you're not just distancing, you're commenting on their behavior. Love for that person also says, well, I hear you say this is how you're behaving, but I want you to understand that this is how it comes across to a young man, and it's not helpful. And so, you know, so just like I've told the girls, there may be a time where you have to tell a young man, your words are too complimentary. I need you to stop. You're drawing out my heart in a way that you've not said you're intending to.
Here's what a lot of girls don't understand, and that is when you flirt with a guy and you're drawing out his romantic affection, you aren't making him at that point want to make a covenant of self-sacrifice and commitment to you. You are drawing him out in a way that makes him want to have you and devour you, ultimately. And it may not seem that way, you know, and he might not even recognize it's probably low level at some level, but you're not making him want to promise his life to you in death and love you and cherish you. So flirting does not elicit that kind of a response from a guy. So don't do it. It's offering yourself up to be used. Other questions? Yes. She's a close friend. I think it'd be loving to have a conversation with her. Ask her questions. You know, start a conversation and then tell her what you think as well. You know, I think that's totally appropriate. Okay, last thing, I want to talk just a second about love. What do you think about our culture when it talks about falling in love? Can you fall in love? It's everywhere, isn't it? It's in all the movies and the Disney films. It's in, you know, the princess movies, and everyone just, you know, fall in love, and there's this emotional thing, and it boom, and you just know that you know because you fell in love. Well, that happens, but it's an emotional infatuation, and it's not biblically defined as love. How do you fall into patience and kindness? I tripped and I fell into patience and into kindness, to not envying or boasting. I fell into not being arrogant or rude. I just tripped and fell into loving Christ and loving you and keeping the commandments toward you. You don't fall into love. Now, there is an affection, a natural human affection, a warmth of feeling, which is totally good, God-given, and appropriate, and is for the marriage context. That's what it's for. But that has to be, that's protected, and we're protected from using and hurting each other by the covenant bond of marriage, which is the covenant of love in marriage, where you promise yourselves to one another. And so, girls, if a guy tells you that he loves you, where's the ring? Because that's the promise. Where's the covenant bond? Otherwise, what's he doing? I love you. That means I want to have you for myself. That's all it means. The covenant bond means I love you. I want to give myself to you forever. Right? So, you want the steak analogy. I do that every year. Joy said, "Don't you don't have to do it this year." I said, "They'll probably ask." And she said,
"Well, there's new people. There's new people.
Okay.
The steak.
So the steak analogy. All right. So this is to the girls, and guys, I think we'll agree with this. But girls, if you wear clothes that are revealing or tight fitting, and this is subjective, so ask your dads. Okay? They'll know. Believe me, and believe them when they tell you. And so we're not asking you to be, you know, like, you know, and all down to here. But if you wear tight-fitting, revealing clothing, then you are asking for a guy to think of you like he thinks of a steak. And how does, just think about how a guy thinks about a juicy steak. When he's hungry, he wants to eat it, and it has all of his attention. And he wants to devour it. He does not want to take care of the steak, does he? So he wants to cherish and protect the steak, serve the steak, give his life up for the steak. No, he wants to eat it. When a man is finished with the steak, he doesn't think about it. He might think, that was good. And that's it, though. His appetite is satisfied, and he's on living his life, right? No reason to keep thinking about it. You're full. Here's another very important one for you to understand. A man does not care which steak he eats. He doesn't. Here's a steak, here's a steak, there's a steak. You know, they're all steaks. Be happy to eat any one of them. And here's another thing. He always gets hungry again. He's eaten one, he'll be hungry, and he might be happy to eat the same cut of steak over and over again, and yet, really, he would like variety. He'd like different ones because he's satisfying his appetite. He wants some different seasoning. He just wants a good tasting meal. And so, girls, if you figured out that you can get a guy's attention by revealing yourself, you're absolutely right. And it might feel good, and it might seem cool, neat to have, might lift your self-esteem to have a guy's attention, or lots of guys' attention in that way, but you are not getting the kind of attention you think you are or that you want. You're getting a totally different kind of attention. And a guy might even say the right things. Say, well, you don't understand. This one really cares about me. But look, guys are really smart. Guys know not to say what they're really thinking, and they'll say whatever it takes. They'll lie to you, and you'll be totally convinced. But what I'm telling you is part of this. Ecclesiastes, remember, says that there's a built-in structure to this world, and you either learn to live within it, or it'll crush you. And this is the structure. Girls, your bodies, when revealed to a man outside of the covenant bond of marriage, he's not thinking of you like anything other than a steak. So, be wise. Guys, make a covenant with your eyes. Cover your eyes, look away, set your eyes upon Christ. And girls, think about your brothers in Christ, and also Christ, to honor him with your body. And also, just think about what you desire, what you really desire as a man to love you. And that's not how you get it. So, other questions?